Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and no, I will not be predicting the dramatic outcome of baseball games. That's a story for another podcast at another time. But I sure hope you are enjoying the baseball playoffs as they are well underway. No, we're continuing our trek through this big old monster box of baseball cards, mostly from the 1980s. Got a few sets from the 1990s in there. And as we pour through it, we move on to 1988, the first year that we have four sets of baseball cards. We're going to talk about the premier set from that season. That, of course, would be the Score baseball cards, which had an up and down tenure over the next several years. 88 was a pretty good set. 89, meh. And then future sets, 90, 91, 92, all stood out for various reasons. So we'll talk a little bit about Score, the premier edition from 1988. Also, our random pull, card number 421, good old Spanky Mike LaValliere, then with the Pittsburgh Pirates, had a pretty eventful, very serviceable career in the major leagues. And of course, his time in Pittsburgh, the years that a lot of fans remember as he was part of those really good, but unfortunately always coming up short Pirates teams of 1990, 91, and 92. First, let's check out our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As always, you're welcome to chime in with any questions, comments, thoughts, opinions, and I always invite you to please share the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter handle with your friends, your collectors. We've picked up quite a few followers over the last few weeks, and I owe it to you for passing on the word not only about our Twitter handle, but also about our podcast, which comes your way via Audio Boom on Tuesdays and Fridays. Now, a lot of reaction to the previous podcast where we were talking about 87 Tops and Why Not. That's the set that everybody loves. Our friends at Baseball Card Back sending us a picture of the back of 87 Tops number 624. And he writes, 87 Tops fronts are iconic and the backs have best comments. I wonder how Tim Burke's enjoyment compares to the average reader. And what he's talking about is the little quip underneath the player's stats. And Tops always had some very intriguing factoids, especially in 87. For Tim Burke's card, it says, Tim experiences much enjoyment from reading. Now, we're assuming that that is an accurate statement and somebody at the Topps offices in Brooklyn, New York wasn't just pulling something out of their rear end because it sounded good. Well, I think he likes to read. What else is he doing in the bullpen all those times? Now, I responded, I wonder if he enjoyed reading that. That would be rather ironic if Tim Burke enjoyed reading the comment about him reading. And Baseball Card Backs actually responded with, of course, probably did a lot of reading while icing his arm during the 1985 rookie season in which he pitched 120 innings in relief. Now, we've had this discussion before about how pitching staffs are used completely different these days, and especially starters. Very rarely do you have starters go in the full nine. Often you get them just through six. You know, they go through the batting order maybe twice, and then managers are pulling them out for various reasons. But yeah, Tim Burke with the Expos in 1985, not only 120 and one-thirds innings pitched in relief, but also 78 games he appeared in. 78 games. That's a third of the Expos season. Relief pitchers, definitely not quite used in that fashion anymore. And there was nothing really special about him. He was a right-handed batter, or a right-handed pitcher, I should say. He was pretty good at what he did. In fact, the first two seasons, he had an earned run average of 2.64. Strikeout-to-walk ratio, almost 2-1. Pretty good win-loss record, 18-11. So it's not like he was a guy that was just getting thrown out there in mop-up duty. He was actually pretty good. But yeah, you definitely do not see pitchers, relief pitchers, getting 120 and one-thirds innings and all in one season in 78 games. If a pitcher these days makes it into 78 games, he's probably only pitching a third of an inning. It's that left-handed specialist that comes in every now and then. So his total innings pitched comes up to like 40 at the end of the season. So very interesting factoid and stats and good conversation with Baseball Card Backs on Tim Burke's 87 Tops card. Now, we asked prior to the 87 Tops podcast, what was your favorite card from the set? We had quite a few people say Jose Canseco. Tim Hargensheimer says the exact same thing. Canseco, because it's Canseco. And because every All-Star rookie deserves a pixelated Gold Bowl trophy. Of course, he's talking about the Topps All-Star Rookie Trophy. And this was the thing that Donruss tried to emulate with their rated rookie cards back in the early 80s. And of course, the rated rookies went on into the early 90s. But while Donruss was often, not always, but often way off the mark with rated rookies, Topps played it safe. You know, Canseco had a pretty phenomenal 86 season with Oakland, and there was no doubt he was going to be a big part of the A's lineup for many years to come. So Topps could feel pretty good about putting the All-Star Rookie Trophy on that card. They always tended to wait just a little bit before they affixed the buzzworthy trophy to the front of their cards, unlike Donruss, which often went out on a limb. Sometimes they got it right. Donruss had Canseco as a rated rookie in 86, Gary Sheffield in 89. You know, there are several good rated rookies throughout the years, but not nearly as much as they probably should have. So thank you very much for sharing that story, Tim, and thank you for listening. And one other comment coming from Waxpack916, recently following us. Welcome to the program, Waxpack916. My iconic sets are 88 and 89 tops. Very interesting, because for a lot of collectors, that wouldn't be the first choice. But he continues, first wax packs given to me by my mom, built both recently, working on 80 now, my birth year. Well, good for you, and I hope you are able to complete that 1980 set sooner than later. Now, my birth year was 77. That's a little harder to come by. Let's just say if I ever pull together the entire 1977 set from Topps, A, I'd have to clear up a lot of student loan debt first to afford it, because there is some star power in that set. And B, it would not be Gem Mint 10. I'm pretty confident about that. So good luck with the 80 set, and an interesting reason why you built 88 and 89 and why they are your most iconic sets. One, because you built them, you collated them, and anytime you put together the time and the effort and the money to build a set, you're always going to have a tighter bond to it than other collectors will. But first wax packs given to me by my mom, that's a great reason to like that set. And even though 87 is my most iconic set, 83 tops is right up there, 77 tops as well, I love 89 tops set. Really underrated. As I've gotten older and the years have gone by and time has stretched between 1989 and now, I go back to that set and I really, really like it. And that was the year. That was the first wax pack for me, was 89 tops. That was the year I got involved in collecting. So that's going to be a special set for me. I think once I finally, and I swear I'm going to do it one of these days, once I finally close out that 87, 90, and 91 sets, I'll get around to 89 tops. I don't have nearly as many of those cards in my collection as I used to. And it's a shame, because I really like the design. And just looking at that looks, you know, it brings back some good memories, looking at those cards, because it was a nice design and really good front to back. And of course, as time has gone on, rookie cars, star power, it certainly had all of it. Well, we'll talk about 89 tops some other time. That's still a few weeks away. We're in 1988 right now. The first set from 1988 is the first set from the People at Score, producing a 660 card set. And our random pull again is card number 421, Mike Levalier of the Pittsburgh Pirates. In a very interesting photo here, it's an action shot, but it's also not really an action shot. You know what I mean? It's, you know, it's Levalier. It looks like he either just threw out a runner at second, something he was very good at doing in his career, or he's directing traffic. And as a catcher, you might be doing both. You never know. But Levalier in a very crystal clear shot here. That was something that separated Score from the other brands, primarily in 1988, because once Upper Deck came around in 1989, everything was off the table in terms of quality and raising the bar. They certainly did that from the very beginning. Now, 88 Score is a quality set in terms of design, in terms of color, in terms of content. We'll get knee-deep into it with the Levalier card in just a moment. But you may be wondering, why was there a new card set in 1988? Well, it goes back to why there were new card sets in 1981. And of course, you know, in years before, there were some new card sets that came around. And one reason why is because of money. lots and lots of money. Dave Jamison, the author of Mint Condition, had this whole storyline here. And I strongly suggest, if you haven't read Mint Condition, to check it out at some point in time. But, you know, he mentioned that the Major League Baseball Players Association back in the late 70s under Marvin Miller, they were looking for any additional forms of revenue. And especially because starting in the late 70s, certainly in 1981, where half the season was missed due to a strike, the players were just looking for any revenue stream possible. And if they were able to officially back a brand of baseball cards, you know, license a new brand of baseball cards in addition to Topps, that would make more money. Of course, Topps ruled the market for about 15 years at this point in time, or excuse me, 25 years, from the mid-50s right up through 1980. And while Topps certainly made good money for the players could make more money by having more sets and by having some competition. You know, companies like Donruss and Fleer and later Score and Upper Deck and all the other versions that came out, basically upping the ante in terms of signing agreements with them. Because Topps had a stranglehold on the market for so long, they would set the price. Baseball players did not get that much money from signing contracts to have their likenesses used in these cards. So by expanding the marketplace and making it a little more competitive, baseball players were able to cash in a little more. And of course, with how tumultuous the, you know, the labor strife in Major League Baseball between the players and the owners in the 1980s and certainly into the mid-1990s, any way the players could grab more and more money, they would do that. So Score comes around not because hobbyists were clamoring for a fourth card set, although because the business was booming at this time, an extra card set was a nice thing to have. It was a bit of a money grab by everybody involved, and that was part of the reason why the house of baseball cards, if you will, came crashing down about 5 or 6 years later. One, of course, is the strike in 1994. That's what killed it for me. I know it killed it for a lot of hobbyists and baseball fans, but it wasn't just the strike, but there was just so many cards out there. And that's why when I look back at my sets, I pretty much stop at 1993. For me, that was the last good season to collect new product. Up until now, I think Topps in particular has put out some really good stuff over the last few years. Well, let's take a look at Score as we look at this Mike Lavalier card. Again, number 421, our random pull. And you'll notice that the Lavalier card is green on the outside border, but that wasn't the only color that Score used. In fact, they used all sorts of colors. They had purple, they had dark blue, they had green, they had kind of a golden yellow, they had red. Basically, in every 110 card subset of the 660 card set, they alternated the color of the outside border. 88, a very colorful set. And as I mentioned, the photography was simply outstanding in this set. Very crisp, clear photographs here. What's also unique with these photographs is inside the external frame, you have this white border. And the way that it's set up, it almost looks like a photographer's cropping tool. And you can do this on any computer program now that edits photographs, or even on your iPhone, you can always crop a photo. Very similar thing here, where it's almost like you've got the full shot and then you've got the center of the action shot inside this little cropping square. And it's something that has actually been, you know, used since a lot of times. 91 and 92 Topps had a very similar look. And, you know, it kind of adds a little action to the action, if you catch my drift here. Now, the Lavalier picture here, as I mentioned, it is kind of an action shot, but certainly not as active as other photographs in the set. And one card that comes to mind is Jose Canseco's card from that set, where he's in mid-swing and probably drilling a ball 400 feet into left field at the Coliseum. But they had a pretty good assortment of action shots, pretty good assortment too of some pose shots. And like I said, it was very crisp, very clear photography. Even though Topps, Fleer, and Donruss all had some great sets in the 1980s, photography was always a bit iffy. Sometimes you get that slightly fuzzy photo, or you get that action shot where there was too much action going on. There were too many players in the picture, or there's just too much dust in the picture of a guy sliding into home plate. Or, as the case may be with Topps, we've discussed before, airbrushing. Well, you didn't see any of that in 88 score. Now, looking at the Lavalier card, if you look at the bottom of the card, you had three stars in the lower left-hand corner. Now, that's not symbolic of Lavalier or any other player. That was just part of the design. Every card had three stars in the lower left-hand corner. The score logo in the lower right-hand corner. And then kind of in this little chevron shape at the bottom, you had this slightly lighter colored triangle and then the player's name and the position, the abbreviated position listed underneath. Now, where does score go bonkers? The backs of the cards. Baseball card backs is going to enjoy this conversation. When you flip it over, there is a whole lot going on. In fact, you may want to get a magnifying glass to read some of this stuff. You know, on a standard baseball card, all of the information and stats that are packed on the back of a scorecard, and it wasn't just 1988. This went on for several years here. This was pretty impressive. I don't know who did the typesetting, but boy, did they have to jam it in here. First of all, most prominent, upper left-hand corner, a big full-color photograph of the picture. That's the big difference between this set and previous sets of cards that had photographs on the back, 71 tops. And then, of course, you had the Fleer sets, 83, 84, and 85. This was the first time that the photograph was not only very large, although 71 tops was large, but in color. So that set it apart from previous sets. You also have the card number in very, very small letters, top middle. Right underneath that, the team name to the right, the team logo. Love that old Pirates logo there. The I don't want to call it a swashbuckler. He just looks like a really salty sailor right there. That's a guy that probably has a wooden leg and at least three bottles of rum inside his belly. And below that, we've got Mike Lavalier's name, his uniform number. That was pretty unique. You didn't see that on a lot of cards. His position, personal information, the professional stats, and that includes minor leagues, which I've always been a fan of. And then the great litany of biographies, which Score was very, very famous for. They certainly applied that here on Lavalier. But if you read it, and again, you're going to have to really zoom in on the picture to read it, but if you read the information that's on the back of this card in particular, and I know other cards from that set, it is just, it's like a scouting report. You know, this isn't just baseball trivia. This isn't Tim Burke likes to read. This is really valuable stuff here. It reads like a scouting report, and if you're living in 1988, again, this is pre-internet, this is pre-18 channels of ESPN, Major League Baseball Network, you name it. You know, most of the information you got back then was box scores and stats on the back of baseball cards or a Bill James encyclopedia. This was very, very detailed information on each player. So even though we mock Score for cramming all of this stuff into the back of the card, they really did a nice job of telling the complete story of the player, going beyond the numbers. And, you know, in the case of Lavalier, talking about his defensive record, throwing out batters, very few, or throwing out base runners, I should say, very few catchers, matching his 50% efficiency, part of a big trade with Tony Pena. You know, it really gets detailed into his very brief career at this point in time. So 88 Score definitely wins on the card backs in terms of content. There's plenty of it in terms of quality of content and really mixing it up and doing something which in 1988 had not been done yet. Now, again, in 89, when Upper Deck comes around, that totally changes the game. And all of a sudden, things like full color photographs on the back and detailed biographies and team logos and uniform numbers, that becomes standard practice over the next few years, not just with Score, but pretty much everybody. I'd say by 1992, had all of those facets into their cards. And then it was just a matter of, well, who would just put out the better set or the better stars or the better rookie cards or the better subsets within the main set. The 88 Score set still remains very popular in terms of design. It's a popular premier edition. This, despite the fact that the market is just totally overloaded with them, much like every other set created from 1988 through 1993. But even though there are a lot of cards that are out there still, and still in factory sealed sets and boxes and packs, it is a nice set to collect. A little hard to keep in gem mint condition because of the various colored borders. But it's still something you can afford. I've seen boxes on sale for anywhere between $10 and $15, which is ridiculously cheap, even for 1988 material. You can get complete sets for probably, depending on where you buy it, $25 to $30, which is still very much in reason. And if you're looking for the 88 score set, and this is something that carried on through Topps, Fleer, and Donruss that year, not really loaded with rookie power. Tom Glavine is the big rookie, probably the most valuable card of the set. But you also have rookie cards, guys like Greg Jeffries, Ken Caminiti comes to mind. Trying to think, there's one other rookie card from that set. Oh, Matt Williams, that's right. You know, all guys who had very good careers, and you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, their rookie cards would have been worth $4 or $5, but because the market's so flooded, 50, 60 cents. They're almost dime a dozen now. There's just so many of them that are out there. But if you want a really beautiful set, a little ahead of its time in terms of color, photograph quality, and certainly the content quality and quantity on the back for a premier set, this is a really good one. And you could argue, in terms of design, that the 88 score set is the best of the four major releases in 1988. I've never been a big fan of 88 Topps. 88 Fleer, you know, kind of on the fence on. Donruss, I like, but of course 88 Donruss gets a really bad rap because there's so much out there. Score is a really nice set. So if you're looking, you know, you got $20 or whatever to spend and you want to try to collate one of these sets because there's only 660 cards, certainly not a very hard thing to do because there is plenty that is out there. Now, we should know a couple of things about the 88 score set. First of all, they released a glossy set that was in limited numbers. How limited? Only 5,000 sets. So even during the production overload days of 1988, 5,000 sets is pretty phenomenal, keeping the numbers down that low. So if you find a glossy set or glossy cards that are in gem mint condition, there is some value to that. It is not, you know, $20 sets here. You know, it's a couple hundred dollars for the set. You can get the Glavine card for a couple hundred dollars as well. So good luck finding those. Very similar to the Topps Tiffany sets of the same era. You know, very limited edition, but high quality set. And of course, the, you know, the Tiffany sets and the glossy sets, they all kind of went by the wayside when Upper Deck made that the norm in 1989, and everybody by the early 90s had caught up to those production techniques. Also, a neat thing about the 88 score set, and a fun thing, the added prize. Do you remember that? Topps had the gum, Fleer had the stickers, Donruss had the puzzle pieces. What did Score have? Do you remember? The Magic Motion trivia cards. Yes, great moments in baseball. Magic Motion cards. They were about the size of a Topps mini card. You know, it you know, slid around in the pack, actually. So it was roughly maybe 60% the size of the regular card. And in the rather kitschy 1970s Magic Motion technology, you basically just held it in your index finger and your thumb, and you would just rock it back and forth, and you would have some kind of neat little, you know, moment in baseball history. I remember the 89 set had World Series moments, or, you know, it would flash a year like 1903, and then you'd move it a little bit, and it would say Athletics versus Pirates, you know, something along those lines. And then if you flipped it over on the back, there was a little detailed description of that particular moment in history, or like I said, the 89 set, you had the, you know, the World Series, a little description on the back. Now, very similar to the Sports Flicks set, and I don't want to completely ignore Sports Flicks. I actually have like three or four cards from 1986 or whatever, but the, you know, that set's been pretty much forgotten over the years. I don't want to say that was ahead of its time because it was using old technology. They were expensive to make. They were expensive to buy. They were kind of kitschy. People didn't really gravitate towards them. So when it came to bonuses inside packs, while this was certainly unique, you didn't rip open a pack of Score baseball cards in the late 80s going, "Oh, I wonder what moment in baseball I got." You just didn't do that. You know, with Fleer, with the stickers, you always liked stickers. You looked forward to stickers. With Topps, if you were able to get a pack early in the season where the gum was kind of sort of fresh, you looked forward to that. Donruss, if you were assembling the puzzle, you were hoping you got the final set of puzzle pieces to complete that. But yeah, the Magic Motion cards didn't necessarily put that very high on your radar. At least I didn't. I'm pretty sure a lot of other collectors didn't. either. Now, let's take a look at Mike LaVoyer, a very interesting career, because this is a guy who is a very underrated catcher, a guy who had a very long career in terms of years, as he spent 12 years in the big leagues from 1984 to 1995, but in terms of number of games, he did not appear in many games. In fact, much of his career, he was a platoon catcher, although he certainly had his heyday in his early years in Pittsburgh, especially in 87 and 88. In fact, 1987, he played the most games of his career in one season, 121 games. He was a unique catcher because most people think, and I know with sabermetrics and, you know, other analytical ways of looking at the game, the catcher is one of those power positions. If you're part of the old school thinking of building a baseball team, and I am, you have your power basically starting from the catcher's position and going up the foul line. So you have your power hitters, catcher first, third, right field, left field. And then you have your skill or your defensive wizards up the middle, second, short, center field. That's also where you typically have your speed. Well, Mike LaVoyer, while he certainly wasn't a bad guy at the plate, certainly did not stand out in terms of power. Career average, 268, not bad. Career number of home runs, 18. That's right, 18 home runs in 879 games. So this was a guy who did not hit him out that often. In fact, in an average season, he would hit three. So not a guy that was going to hit it 450 feet over the fence and, you know, clear the bases. He was not known as an RBI machine as well, 294 career RBI, an average of 54 per season if he was playing, you know, 162-game average. And again, he didn't play 162 games. He often played maybe half that schedule throughout his career. So this was a guy that you didn't look to as an offense generator, as an offensive machine, as a guy that, you know, if you had runners in scoring position, he was going to knock them in. Again, he wasn't bad. 268 batting average, on base percentage 351, OPS of 689. So certainly not bad. He would deliver when he needed to deliver. But Mike LaVoyer, best known for his defensive skills. He was a Gold Glove winner in 1987 with the Pirates. And his career numbers, this guy was money behind the plate. 992 fielding percentage, only 35 errors in 850 games, including 747 starts. And what's really impressive to me, in 850 games, only 34 passed balls. So this was a guy that, you know, if the ball got past him, it was not his fault. He very rarely had the pass ball. And in fact, wild pitches, because he was so sound defensively. And part of it was his build. He was a big, stocky guy. 216 wild pitches allowed during his career. So 850 games, 216 wild pitches. That is roughly one wild pitch every four games. This was a guy who could really help your pitching staff. And he certainly did that with the up-and-coming Pittsburgh Pirates teams of the late 80s and early 90s. Now, before he got to Pittsburgh, he had a couple of cups of coffee with other teams. As Mike LaVoyer, coming out of Charlotte, North Carolina, went to school at UMass Lowell. And again, he was a stocky guy, 5'10", 180 pounds. He was ambidextrous. Not that he was a switch hitter at the plate, but he batted left, threw right. Not totally unheard of, but a little unusual. He was a free agent signee by the Philadelphia Phillies in 1981. He was actually a third baseman in college, and they converted him to catcher in the Philly system. He came up through the Philly system, played just a handful of games with Philadelphia. I mean, literally a handful. Let me see. He had six games with the Phillies in 1984 before they moved him to St. Louis in a conditional deal. Now, apparently the conditions were not met. 10 days later, he goes from St. Louis back to Philadelphia. 10 days after that, he's granted a free agent. 1 month after that, he's signed as a free agent by the Cardinals. So he had this very bizarre six-week dance between Philadelphia and St. Louis, ended up settling in with St. Louis, started playing a more pivotal role with the Cardinals teams of 85 and 86, got to the World Series in 85, losing to Kansas City in seven games. Then he was part of a very big trade at the start of the 87 season. He was traded along with Mike Dunn and Andy Van Slyke to Pittsburgh for Tony Pena. This is one of those deals that actually worked out for both teams. Even though the Cardinals kind of took a step backwards in terms of playoff appearances and win-loss records, Tony Pena had a very a good few years as the catcher, the starting catcher in St. Louis, and he won quite a few Gold Gloves in his career as well. Well, LaVallière would stand out as the number 1A catcher for the Pirates. Of course, like I said, he was mostly platoon throughout his career. But Andy Van Slyke was the star center fielder for the Pirates for many, many years. And those two guys in particular, along with Barry Bonds, Bobby Bonilla, and let's talk about some of those young pitchers for the Pirates. You had Doug Drabek and John Smiley. You know, you had a very good, young, dynamic team under Jim Leland in the late 80s and early 90s that challenged for contention year after year after year. They would lose to the Reds in the NLCS in 90. They would lose to the Braves in the NLCS in 91. And they would lose in massive, heartbreaking fashion to the Braves in 92 as Mike LaVallière was the poor schmo who nearly got Sid Bream out at home plate. Remember that game 7 of the NLCS? Sid Bream hustling like a milk truck without brakes, running down the third baseline. And the throw comes in, and LaVallière catches it, and he does the sweep back, and Bream just beat out the tag there. So a rather ignominious finish to the 92 season. He would be released by the Pirates early in April of 1993, signed with the Chicago White Sox shortly thereafter, played a couple seasons with the White Sox, and wrapped up his career in 1995, his last game, September 22nd of 1995. Now, what's interesting is LaVallière, going into the 1993 season, was actually getting paid $2.35 million. Now, in today's terms, a platoon catcher getting $2.3 million is nothing. But in 1993, he was 32. Again, a 1A catcher, a guy who could give you 110, 120 games. And he was getting $2.3 million. So not to say that this was necessarily a wise investment, but clearly the Pirates and then later the White Sox, they would supplement that pay. They paid him much, much less during the final couple of seasons in his career in Chicago. He had enough value for his defensive game and for helping out pitching staffs as a whole. He was worth that money to those who signed the contract. So even though Mike LaVallière is not remembered as this great player, and he's one of several good players in the Pittsburgh organization back in the late 80s and early 90s, he got paid some pretty big bucks compared to the scale at the time. He got paid some pretty good bucks for being, you know, statistically, offensively, an average catcher, but defensively, a pretty, pretty good defensive gem. Again, a Gold Glove winner just once. A little bit of a hard luck guy, too, as I mentioned. Lost the World Series in 85, lost all those National League Championship Series in 90, 91, and 92. And, of course, lost the American League Championship Series in 1993 when the White Sox lost to the Blue Jays. So three times out of five times that he was involved in a championship series or a World Series, his team lost to an eventual champion, Kansas City in 85, Cincinnati in 90, and Toronto in 93. Now, after his career wrapped up, he has moved on to being an advisor and being a coach, a youth coach. He now teaches baseball lessons and holds camps at a place called Big League Experience. So not going down the realm of coaching or broadcasting like many former players do, but teaching the youths of America how to properly frame pitches and block out those wild pitches to keep those pass balls down and to make your pitchers look pretty good. So Mike LaVallière, card number 421 of 660 from the remarkably sharp and very nice 88 score set. Again, if you're looking to pay off student loans or to raise enough money to do some work around the house by buying and selling 88 score, I wish you the best of luck with it, because it is not the smartest investment. You can buy these quite literally pennies a piece. You can sell them quite literally pennies a piece. But if you're a collector, and again, you don't want to spend too much money for a very nice premier edition card set, 88 score is a pretty good one. All right, from the premier set of 88 score, we go into the much maligned 88 Donruss, a set whose design I actually like. It has some star powers, has some good rated rookies, I should add. But unfortunately, there's still about 800 billion I might be off by a couple hundred billion, 800 billion 88 Donruss cards still floating around there in their factory sealed packs and boxes and cases and sets. We'll talk about the 88 Donruss set and how we're still swimming around in these cards in our next podcast, which will come your way Tuesday. That is, if Hurricane Matthew doesn't screw up things around here in my home state of Florida. In the meantime, chime in with your thoughts about this set or anything else on your mind in the world of collecting on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. And again, please share this podcast and our Twitter handle, Wax and Gum Stains, with your friends. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic.